It's good to be here, and I must have a new book out. But it's not just that. When Peter asked me for a title, I thought I'd be dramatic and say "Rebooting the Church," which sounds very dramatic. But I think once we're finished here, you'll know where I'm getting at. So there was a report recently that suggested that, looking at what's going on with the Jewish people in this country, we're looking at a population which is what 0.5% of our country, Jewish people. And yet, according to statistics and a recent survey, that 0.5% is hated by 21% of the population. That is the statistics for the people who are, let's say, fulfill the criteria for anti-Semitism. And that is an amazing fact. And the suggestion was that the Jewish community is spending millions on trying to fight it, in terms of increasing security and trying to get messages out there and lobbying parliament and such and such. And the suggestion was that wouldn't it be great if there were any groups in society who are supporting the Jewish people? And whatever the politicians may say, they would not be counted in any group. And the saddest thing is that the most obvious group who ought to be supporting the Jewish people is the church. Problem is, the church historically is the main problem and always has been for 2,000 years. And in my recent book, I've suggested that the main reason why Jewish people don't get their Messiah is because of the church. It should have been the other way around. The church are there to make Jewish people jealous. We read that in Romans 11, and the church ought to be witnessing to the Jews, but it hasn't. It has shown the wrong Jesus, and I know that from my experience, from my mum's experience, and any of you who are Jewish. We are bred in our DNA to feel negatively about Jesus. We can't help it. It's 2,000 years of our ancestors being persecuted and killed in the name of Jesus. The same Jesus, but it's not the same Jesus, because the Jesus of the Crusaders and the Jesus of the pogroms and the Jesus of the Inquisition is not the Jewish Jesus that we all know and worship. But the problem is, Jewish people don't know that. They only know the history. So it's no wonder why they don't come through. Jewish evangelism is a difficult task, and it's not, certainly in this country, I don't see any major sort of advances in the kingdom in terms of Jewish people. So it's up to the church. The church has to reboot itself. Okay. Just to give you a size of the problem, and this is very much an aside, and some of you would have read in the news, perhaps you have to go on social media to actually pick these things up. But there's been efforts from the Green Party in Sheffield, Brighton, and Bristol to basically do what the Nazis did on Kristallnacht, and that is victimize Jewish people by knocking on doors of Jewish households. Or households, and saying to them, "Are you Jewish or are you positive towards Israel? If so, we're going to put you on the list," basically. And what they'll use that list for, we don't know. And it's a sort of a scheme by the Green Party to root out anything to do with the apartheid state of Israel in terms of BDS and boycotts and such. And they're doing it by knocking on houses, And the thing is, they've been approached by sensible people, and they have no self-awareness what they're doing. They just do not realize the harm that they are doing. And I was telling Monica, it brings me back to that they're channeling the Wizard of Oz. They're brainless, they don't have a heart, and they're cowards, basically. And that is it for all those who have been sucked in to say the pro-Palestinian lobby. And the problem is when it gets into the church, and that's what I want to talk about, is the church itself. Now, I've got a friend, some of you know, those of you who've been around a bit may remember Fred Harris, Fred, sorry, Fred Harris, Fred Wright, the writer. He's been a writer for many years. He actually does a lot more in Aliyah at the moment with the, I think it's called the Ezra Foundation or something. But he wrote a book, maybe Steve Hamblin will remember it, called Father Forgive Us, which he wrote back in the 90s. It was the first book that talks about Christian anti-Semitism. And he's now working on a follow-up book. I've got a title of it somewhere, because he wants me to help edit it. The trouble is, it's got 1,500 pages. Can you imagine? It's going to be the ultimate book on Christian anti-Semitism and replacement theology, basically. And well, what he's done, and this is what I'm going to go through, is that he has done, I think, a great service to us in producing what he calls the protocols of sort of for meaningful dialogue between Christians and Jews. He's come up with 28 protocols, and what I want to do is go through them quickly, commenting on them. You know, if we had a full commentary on this, we'll be doing this for a week or 2 weeks, because just one or two of these points are massive points. But we have to realize that when you listen to these points, you realize how far our church has gone from understanding their Jewish background and understanding the damage they have done to Jewish evangelism, and understanding the damage they've done to themselves through being anti-Semitic, because that's what replacement theology is, and it is the default. I'm sure you've had many talks on replacement theology, so I'm not going to go into the details of that, simply to say that if you've got people who say that the church has replaced the Jews, then that gives the Jews the status of a replaced people, which it isn't too far to go from there to actually say, okay, if they're replaced, then they're worthless. God doesn't care about them. Let's just, put them to one side because God has finished with them. And that is a natural outcome from believing what is the default theology in our country. So I'm going to go through these 28 things. So some of them I'll do very quickly, but it'll get give you an idea of the problems that we have. So number one, which is a simple one, just to say, perhaps I know some of you might want to write them all down, or you can probably hear it on the replay, but this is going to be an article in Sword magazine. Those of you who get Sword, it will be sort of the main article in Sword, and I'll probably also put it on my website. And I'll give you links to it, and you can have a look at it then. So, because it's a lot to write down. So, number one, acknowledge that both Jews and Christians worship the same God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I think we can do a tick on that, and I think I would suggest that most Christians do get that. One would hope. Number two, the church is grafted into the covenant. It has not displaced, replaced, or superseded the Jews and become the sole beneficiary of the scriptures, prophets, and the work of Messiah. So this is classic replacement theology, which I just mentioned. And as I said, it's the default in this country. Now, I've been in discussions with people over, a lot of you will know N.T. Wright. Now, N.T. Wright is the preeminent theologian in our country. He's like let's say, the Pope of the Church of England, in a sense, in that everyone looks up to him as the person that knows everything. And in particular, he's done a lot of studies on Paul in the New Testament, and he's written a book on Paul, and I think it's got something like 1,500 pages and all that. But the thing is, he's been challenged, and I've seen the interview because our son Phil actually filmed it, and he showed it to me, and he was being interviewed, and he was asked, "Do you believe in replacement theology?" And he said, no. And then they asked him to explain. So what does he think of the Jews? During his explanation, he didn't mention the word Jews once. He called Jews Judeans, which might sound very subtle, but why not mention Jews? And when he mentioned Israel, it was always the sense of when Paul talks about Israel, he's talking about the Israel of God, which includes Gentiles. So if that's not classic replacement theology, I don't know what is. And the thing is that he's a person that thousands of ordinary Christians are looking up to, and they will get their theology for him because they will say to themselves, he's clever, he's written books, so he must be right. So let's follow what he says, and rather than think for themselves, rather than look into the word themselves, I challenge anyone to read Romans 11 and not realize, that there is literal God saying that the Jewish people are still functional and still have a future and still are part of God's plan. How you can believe in any other way is proof that there's something else that is, let's say, running you, is impacted your spirit in some way. And yeah, it's horrible to say that, but anti-Semitism is there, and I'd even say NT Wright is channeling it just as much as any other. So it's a massive issue, and I'm going to go, if I get there by the end of this, we're going to end with a challenge. There has to be a challenge, because it's all okay me talking about it and other people talking about it, but as I've said to some people, and I mentioned this, I think, when I was at the bridge, is that this Yiddish word called tachlis, I only heard of it when I listened to a Jewish podcast, and it's a word that those of you who remember my mother will know that she totally modeled tachlis. And tachlis is going into a meeting and saying, shut up and get on with it. She is always doing that. She is always getting to the heart of everything and saying, we've talked enough, let's do something. And it is time that those of us who get Israel are actually brave enough to put our heads above the parapet and do our best to show the rest of the church that not only are they going against Jewish people, which is obvious, but they're going against God. Because the Jewish people are still precious to God, and in the end, at the end of everything, there's only two powers out there, and it's God and Satan. You're either with one or the other, even if you're a Christian, and if you are anti-Semitic or if you're into replacement theology, you are on the wrong side, and we're on the correct side, otherwise you wouldn't be here. But we have to feel for those that are on the wrong side, and we have to decide, is it ignorance? Is it something that is just that they've never been told about it by their church? In a sense, you could say that's perhaps not their fault then, but or is it willful ignorance, which means they've purposely taken this position? And I suggest that those who are willfully ignorant, they're the ones that are in trouble and need prayer and need to change. But those who are just plain ignorant need to be told the truth. Because it's affecting every, it's affecting, it doesn't affect Jews so much because we're used to it. Just like, in fact, I think Melanie Phillips says that there's no point pumping all this money into defending ourselves. We know they hate us. We're not going to change the world in that way. But what we do need is those who get it, those in the church who ought to get it, have to be out there defending the Jewish people. Okay. Anyway, I said there's 28. I'm still on number two. So I better go through them a bit quicker. Number three, acknowledge that the Christian is not superior to the Jew. The Jew remains God's representative people. They're still chosen. At no point did God say, you're not chosen anymore. So we won't go further into that. The Christian church must acknowledge and accept its responsibility for the anti-Semitism that grew and was nourished and promulgated from the Hellenization of the gospel from its early apologetics. You can see this has been written by an academic. History cannot be changed. It has already happened. And this is just how sort of Greek thinking has pervaded the church for 2,000 years. I've written nine books on the subject, so but I won't go into that at the moment. Number five, despite shameful Christian attitudes towards Jews in history, Christians should not be ashamed of the gospel. This is interesting. It remains the power of God for salvation to the Jewish people first. Romans 1:16. This priority should not be ignored. And Monica remembers as much as I do of a sermon given by a friend of ours in our old church, the church before, I mean St Andrew's, where he says, I'm now going to preach from Romans 1:16. And he forgot to mention the bit about the Jews. And I thought, that is typical. He didn't mean it. It probably wasn't willful, but it just shows you how subtle the conditioning is in our church. For the Jews just not to have a say in anything. Okay, that's number five. Number six, build bridges built based upon mutual respect and understanding. Avoid caricatures. Interesting. Christians should have a working knowledge of Jewish people, their history, their theology, and the Jewish context of the teachings of Jesus. and first century Judaism. That might be a little bit a step too far for a lot of people, but just to understand that Jesus was Jewish as a start, and to go from there. We're not asking for everyone to be theologians overnight, but I think what happens is once, and a lot of you could attest to this, that once you discover that Jesus is Jewish, it sets you on this sort of voyage of discovery, and it enhances your faith. It's not something that you should be forced into. It should be natural to want to know more about his Jewishness, because it's just explained so much. And again, that's another sermon itself. So, number seven, acknowledge our spiritual debt to the Jews and support them materially where needed. He's talking about Christians helping and Aliyah and things like that. Again, that's he would put that because that was the area that he does most work in. Number eight, acknowledge that the scriptures arose from the Jews and their covenant relationship with God. I'm going to rush through a lot of these. So, number nine, acknowledge that Jesus was born into, grew up, and lived his life as an observant Jew in Judea before the destruction of the temple. Again, it's understanding Jesus in his Jewish concept, Jewish context. Recognize number 10, recognize the common origins of both Christianity and rabbinic Judaism. Understand the historical reasons why they eventually separated. It's good to have a history of why Jews did, sort of move away from Christianity. Well, the obvious answers is the church. But even within rabbinical Judaism, it's interesting to see the defenses they put up in the Talmud and in their writings to actually stop their own people from going anywhere near Christians. And the culmination of that is where we see today. That there's nothing worse for people like me or Chantal or any Jewish person here to try to communicate with a let's say a non-Christian Jew or anything to do with Israel. We can't move to Israel because we're the enemy. And anything we try to do with a Christian community, the Jewish community, will be viewed on with great suspicion because we are traitors. And they'll always believe that. And we are traitors, not because we're following an alien god, but because we're following who they think is an alien god. That's the thing. Jesus is this alien god who hates Jews, in their opinion. And that's what we're up against. So it's up to the church to re-educate Jewish people. If we want them to know their Messiah, we have to explain who the Messiah is. And show them that the Messiah isn't who history has pointed to in the sense of how Christians have behaved. So, as I say, there's a lot of work to be done in church being rebooted. Number 11. Okay, oh, that's a bit technical. No one going there. Some of them are quite technical. So I've just, because otherwise we're never going to finish. Recognize that gospel writers, Paul and the other writers, were all theocentric, God-centered. And what he's basically saying is that the Old Testament was important to the, and we should not disregard the Old Testament because it's the only scriptures, obviously, that Jesus had, and the gospel writers. How many Christians you see who say, "Oh, we're New Testament. We're called red letter Christians. Let's forget about the Old Testament. That's all gone. Let's forget about Jews. They're all gone. Let's forget about the God of the Old Testament. He's now the spanking new spiritual Jesus." This is as Steve would know, this is a heresy from the first century called Marcionism, and it's still around in the church, unbelievably, after 2,000 years, and that's where replacement theology comes from. Acknowledge that 80% of the New Testament of the Christian Bible contains quotations or allusions to the Hebrew Bible, and about 10% of the teachings of Jesus likewise. Again, we have to sort of see the continuity between what we call the old and the new. Perhaps one of the worst things we can think about is to call the Old Testament old. It's not old, is it? There are better terms, and I can't actually think of any, but there are. And the way that we contrast the old and the new by using two words that seem so opposite, and it just does give the impression of the new replacing the old. So it's almost a sense of part of our reboot is to reclaim the Old Testament and give it a term that sort of indicates continuity between the old and the new. Acknowledge there are a number of scriptures that may only be applied to the Jewish people, and we can go through a lot of those. And he makes a mention on, now I'm not sure what Bibles he's talking about. I'm sure Steve would know this, but the heading of Isaiah chapter 40, in a lot of older Christian Bibles, actually said God comforts his church, where it actually says comfort, comfort my people, meaning in context the Jewish people. But some Bibles have actually had it, you know, what's the church doing, you know, in Isaiah, you know. Recognize that both allegory and typology, influenced by Hellenistic thought, have shaped both Hebrew Bible texts and a number of New Testament texts. Again, it's trying to understand what is from Greek philosophy, and what has been put there by God in, because certainly some typology is fine, some allegory is fine, but you know, we need to understand, you know. And the trouble is, you only understand according to how you've been taught. And those of us, and I'm sure a few of you will be alongside me in saying that when we were formative Christians, we had good teachers. You know, I will never forget David Pawson and Derek Prince and Arnold Fruchtenbaum and all that. And I'm thinking, yeah, the current generation, who've they got? You know, Steve Chalk, N.T. Wright, you know, Mickey Mouse. I mean, who knows where they're getting their theology from? But we had solid men of God who spoke the truth, and they were all positive about Israel. But you don't get that with the modern writers in general. They're not all bad. But number 19, acknowledge that both Jews and Christians are called to demonstrate God's presence in the world. This is a big one. It's possibly the biggest one, looking at it now. Jews and Christians together, one new man, never really happened, but we ought to still strive for it. As such, there should be a movement towards reconciliation. Okay, there needs to be forgiveness, there needs to be reconciliation. We're a long way from that, and this is all part of rebooting the church, which again I think is necessary. Number 20, acknowledge that God's promises and covenants to the Jewish people concerning the land of Israel are irrefutable and binding, and there is a curse from God upon those who wish to divide the land. And we know, as in modern history, how those curses sometimes have been carried out, and God hasn't forgotten. Now I've heard N.T. Wright and others, when confronted about Israel, the land, it's like it's an accident of history. Everything that's gone on in Israel is a coincidence. You know, and I'd love to sit N.T. Wright down with a theologian and go through what's happened over the last 2 years. Say, yeah, Israel, just like any other country, you know, and there's this thing called Israel derangement syndrome. You know, the world is happy to focus on Israel at the total exclusion of every other country in the world, but not in a positive way. And if that's not a sense of saying there's something unusual about that country, you know, even if people are going against it, what they should be looking at is the fact that Israel itself has been a blessing, and is still being a blessing, and is blessed. Because you speak to any economist or politician, and Israel is in a stronger position now than it was 2 years ago, in terms of the shekel and its economy. You know, how much money they've spent on, you know, on that war, and yet they're still thriving. You know, you've got to think what's going on there. And the other thing is, Israel, the imperative of Jewish people has always been to be the light of the world, light to the world, as Jesus obviously is as well, and we are meant to be. But when you think of what the actual the byproducts of what has happened over the last 2 years in Israel has shed light on so much that is evil in our world. And it's not like Israel have done it on purpose, but think now what your opinions are concerning Islam, politicians in general, the United Nations, the BBC, the media, in a sense of what has happened over the last 2 years. It's all been through what's happened in Israel. It has shown the hypocrisy, the greed, the evil powers in this world, the growth of anti-Semitism out of the blue, the left, where have their brains gone? The people who call themselves progressives, I saw an interview recently with a professor. This is a professor who was cancelled 10 years ago from his university professor. He was cancelled by his peers for lecturing about the British Empire in a positive way. And they hated it, so they cancelled him. So, and these were prominent professors and doctors and students. They cancelled him. And he said, not one of them actually said, let's debate the issue. They didn't want the debate. They wanted him to be wiped out. They wanted his record to be scrubbed from everywhere and no one to go to any of his lectures and for him to be kicked out of his job. He's fought back against that. And his observation is a shrewd one, an interesting one. And he says, all those people, not just the students, but also those who go on the pro-Palestinian rallies, the reason why they're doing it has nothing to do with truth. This current generation are not interested in truth because if they were, they wouldn't be doing what they're doing. They have a defect in their character. They have a lack of meaning in their lives. Now, this is interesting. This shows you the gap that is there for evangelism, because these people are finding that if they sort of belong to a cause, however bad that cause is, it still brings them together with people, and they think they're doing the right thing. One of the things they keep saying is, we want to be on the right side of history. And what they don't realize is it is a total opposite, because one day they're going to look back and think what absolute idiots they've been, because the truth has nothing to do with it. And this is the culture of our society at the moment. It creates morons out of perfectly intelligent middle class people who just want to belong. That's all it is. It's a psychological need. And there's another word for it, which I've used a few times and I've totally forgotten it. So I won't give it to you. It will come to me in a minute. Yeah. That's a shame. I'll think of it in a minute. And that's the problem. And we find that the truth, is a relativistic thing now. Truth, Bible truth, does not cut it with people, and that's why we've got the most articulate people in society. They all speaking up for the cause of Israel. The people like Douglas Murray and Brendan O'Neill and the chaps at Trigonometry, and they're intelligent people and they all get it. It's the others who feel that they need to join in with a cause that just makes them feel important. And that's what it is, the need for importance. They're not getting it through us. So that's a challenge for our evangelism. And we may find that through the church as well, that even those Christians who are rallying to the Palestinian cause are doing it out of a defect in their own theology and in their own relationship with God. So, there's a lot of major problems here. So, I'm going on too long. I'll just finish off. Restore. The church must repudiate the teaching of contempt that developed in relation to Israel and the Jewish people. Pursue the calling of Romans 11:14 to make Israel jealous, which is obviously not happening. It's the opposite that's happening. So there needs to be something going on there. Helping the biblical call for the Gentiles to assist in Aliyah, to develop a biblical eschatology, end times. Steve Hamblin's big word there. To recognize and include the Jewish people and the land of Israel within the process. Recognize that the Holocaust is part of both Jewish and Christian history. That's important. Avoid offensive terminology. The term Jew is often used in a pejorative sense. People just need to, and I have detected anti-Semitism in Gentiles who are believers. Maybe you have to be Jewish to do that. And sometimes it's unconscious, and it is so much a part of the culture of Western people. They don't realize when they're expressing such things, and sometimes it can be offensive to Jewish people, but we're too polite. We're actually not known for our politeness, but we are too polite to actually call people up on it. But maybe it's time just to be honest, keep alive the memory of offence as a safeguard for the future and seek reconciliation. Okay, so Fred's forthcoming new book, he's going to be calling it The Spectre of Anti-Semitism and Theology After Auschwitz. That's a nice punchy title. No doubt we'll change that into some three-word title, but that's it. That's 28 points, and we could go on for ages talking about it, but just going back, just to summarize, that it's okay just reading these things and saying yes, I agree, but it's another thing about wanting to do something about it. And I believe this year, I certainly I'm a part of some initiatives that are going to be happening, and I heard of other initiatives within, let's say, the Christian Zionist movement. Perhaps that something has to happen. We need to get the church to turn around, because the world needs it. Let alone the Jews and let alone Christians, the world needs to see a church that actually operates in truth, because they're not getting that from the Church of England. And they're not getting that from the major denominations, but they need to get it from those of us who see ourselves as the grassroots. We're the church. We are the church. Denominations are basically political entities. So, okay, I think I'm happy to answer any questions. I think you have a time for that, don't you? Afterwards, if you want to do it now or if you want to do it later, that's fine. I'll still hang around. But I think I've given you enough to think about it's not your normal Bible study, but sometimes there are other things you need to know. We need to be motivated into action. Tachlis, just remember that word. And buy the book. There you go, that's the advert. Okay, that's me done.